Dylan lives in Tennessee. He's a magazine editor, he has a wife, he has a young daughter, and he has Alport syndrome, a hereditary kidney disease. The disease is caused by a gene abnormality that codes for a type of collagen that's necessary for the normal function of the kidneys and also the ears and eyes. So Alport syndrome affects not only the kidneys, but also often sight and hearing. In this episode of Lifespan, Dylan describes his years on kidney dialysis, his hearing loss, how a kidney transplant recently transformed his life, and the uniqueness of being part of an extended family with so many members affected by an inherited disease.
My mom knew about it before I was born. Her family was very aware of it, and she was told that having kids was not a good idea and, you know, not 100% safe for her. But her and my dad, after being married for a couple of years, decided to go ahead and have a child anyway, which was me. They actually had me tested at a very young age. And really, you can't diagnose Alport's through anything other than just, you know, an actual biopsy of the kidney. But when you do blood tests and urine tests, there's certain signs that show up, like protein and blood in the urine. And so they were pretty sure early on that I was, I did have this disease, the hereditary disease that ran in our family. But my mom was very sure to always make sure that it didn't affect my life or, you know, how I lived. I would always just drink a little bit more water, take some cranberry pills. But other than that, you know, I think my childhood was very similar to anyone else's.
So did your mom have Alport's syndrome?
Yes, she did. She did.
And that's why they said that it would be dangerous for her to become pregnant, because kidney function, I mean, all kinds of thing happens to women's bodies when they're pregnant, and there's a lot more demand on the kidneys. Was that why they were worried?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, exactly. They just told her it wasn't a very good idea. It wasn't very safe for her. And you know, some of our family has been told, you know, to, I don't know, they don't necessarily say don't procreate, but they just kind of warn that, you know, it does seem so prevalent on my mother's side of the family that, you know, it seems like some people just want to, you know, put it to an end. But, you know, luckily most of our family has not let that stop them from having children. So
you were aware of this then as a child, and were you aware of how it affected your mother's health?
No, she was a school teacher when she was younger. And then by the time I was born and younger and learned what she did, she was a principal and assistant principal at a high school in Houston, Texas. But she really didn't do much differently as well. You know, she was lived very much her life and her lifestyle. And then, you know, it really didn't affect her until she got into her early 50s or late 40s.
So was she on dialysis at some point in her life?
Yes. And that was the big kind of life event for me. She did almost 5 years of in-center hemodialysis. And I moved back home to help take her to the centers 3 times a week and pick her up, and it was a very difficult time for her, and it was a difficult time for me as well. She did not respond well to hemodialysis. She did not enjoy it, or any of those things. And so, yes, she did. She was on it for almost 5 years.
Now, we should explain how important the kidneys are. And you know more than I do, so feel free to correct me in any way that I'm wrong. But the kidneys are basically the body's filtering system, that they clean the body of anything that needs to be cleaned, and everything goes through the kidneys. And if the kidneys aren't functioning properly, then dialysis, you have to have your blood filtered by a machine if your kidneys aren't working properly.
Yes, that's 100% correct. And, you know, it just affects so many other things, in the equilibrium of your body, that when your kidneys start not doing their job or not doing the job that you need them to do, it can start throwing so many other things off balance. And part of our Allport's syndrome disease is as well, it also accompanies with hearing loss and eye abnormalities. And so that's just another, you know, fun thing that we deal with in addition to the kidney problem. So I was really the first one in my family to get hearing aids. I currently wear two hearing aids. I got my first hearing aid when I was in ninth grade of high school. So that was not fun either because I was very athletic and always playing sports. And that just didn't make playing sports very easy when you either A, couldn't hear very well, or B, you were trying to wear hearing aids while you were, you know, sweating and running and jumping. So.
And also for a child in any way to stand out as not, and putting this in quotes, as quote normal, is for a child is not pleasant.
Exactly. It was definitely a battle with my parents. You know, I wasn't excited about it, but I did have to admit that I had gotten to a point in that part of my, you know, childhood in ninth grade where I needed something. You know, I could definitely tell that something was not, I was not hearing as well as I should be. So.
Now, how old were you when your mother started doing dialysis, and how old are you now?
I'll be turning 41 in May. So I'm currently 40. My birthday's in May 6th. My mom started dialysis. She passed away in 2018, and she had her kidney transplant in 2011. And so she did dialysis from about 2006 to 2011. And so I was in my late 20s and early 30s.
So it sounds like the syndrome caught up to her later than it caught up to you. Is that right? I'm just thinking about your different ages when you needed to be on dialysis.
It's very normal, unfortunately, with Allports that it affects the men a lot earlier. They do say that the life expectancy for women with Allports is pretty normal, whereas for men, it definitely affects the lifespan.
I asked Dylan if his daughter has shown signs of Allport syndrome.
Unfortunately, yes. In the past couple of years, we've taken her to a children's nephrologist and a urologist, and just to be safe, she's showed some signs, and you know she's had some things that make us think that she's definitely either a carrier or also has the syndrome. But you know, like I said, they told us that it's not something to worry about too much because of how Allports usually affects females later on in life. But, you know, we're just going to keep an eye on her and have, you know, yearly annual visits and check everything and make sure nothing is too out of whack and we're keeping everything. You want to monitor it. And then also you want to, you know, delay it for as long as possible, I guess, is the best way to say it.
And what can you do to delay it?
Really? I don't know. You know, they tell us to really drink a lot of water. I always did that. I grew up in Houston. It was hot. That wasn't a problem. I was always willing to drink the water. I think, you know, just a healthy lifestyle, you know, stay away from caffeine, carbonation, you know, things, just normal things that other people are probably told not to overindulge in as far as their diet is concerned. And then, you know, some people take fish oil or cranberry pills, and those are just things that, you know, certain nephrologists or research has shown can help the kidneys or slow down, you know, some sort of kidney problem.
For years, because he often accompanied his mother when she went for 3 times a week dialysis treatments, Dylan had seen firsthand how debilitating treatments at a dialysis center can be.
I had told my wife that, and, you know, at that point, we had thought that that meant that I would not do dialysis. And so that's a very, you know, large decision to make, but we had, you know, kind of talked about that. And then after my mom passed away, my health started to deteriorate quite quickly. And so I asked my nephrologist, you know, if I'm not interested in in-center dialysis, are there any other options? And she said that they actually do have a type of dialysis that you can do at home. And it's called PD for short. I think it's peritoneal is the technical peritoneal dialysis. And so when I went into the dialysis clinic, I asked them if I would be a decent candidate for that. And they said yes. And so I did get the surgery. You get, my daughter used to call it a straw, but you get basically like a port put in your stomach, and then you put liquids, that liquids go in through that port into your stomach, and they sit there for a little bit. We call it dwelling. And then the dialysis machine pulls that liquid out of you. And so it's not using the blood like they do with in-center hemo, but it is the same kind of idea as well as where they're putting this fluid in, and it's grabbing all of the stuff that your kidney can't get rid of and can't process. And then that's pulling out of that out of your body. The first, I'd say, year and a half that I was on dialysis, I was only doing it maybe three times a week as well, like the people that do in-center.
As Dylan explains, some patients needing dialysis can qualify for dialysis at home. The patient puts a cleaning fluid called dialysate into the catheter tube surgically placed in their abdomen. Dialysate drains into the peritoneal cavity, where it absorbs waste products from the blood vessels lining the part of their abdomen called the peritoneum. The fluid is drawn back out of the catheter tube and discarded. Like dialysis machines at dialysis centers, the cleaning fluid does the work the kidneys normally do to cleanse the blood.
But unfortunately, after about 2.5 years, my health just started to take, you know, another turn for the worse. And I actually was doing it almost 5 times a week before I got my transplants.
I asked Dylan if he could be mobile while the fluid did its work.
Unfortunately, not only do you have to sit there, but you also have to be very clean and very careful, because it's very easy to get, infections when you have the PD dialysis with this port. And so I had the machine set up next to my bed. I believe that's what most people do. And I would usually start around, 6 p.m., earlier, later, depending on, how much sleep or how early I had to get up the next morning. And it would usually go for about 8 hours. And so there is a connection that would give you about 4 to 5 feet. And so I could move around a little bit in our bedroom, and I could make it to our bathroom, which luckily wasn't too far away from our bed and the nightstand where I had the dialysis machine. But I was very much felt restricted to our bedroom for about the 4.5 years that I did dialysis. I felt very restricted to our bedroom. So yes.
Yeah, that's really tough. Now, you described as your health, when you realized you had to go on dialysis, as your health started to go downhill. Tell us a little bit about the symptoms of kidney failure.
I was lethargic. I didn't have the energy. I was still a soccer coach back at that time. And so that stood out even more when I was, I would finish my day job and go coach soccer. I just didn't have the energy that I had, doing it 3 to 5 years previously. Other things that you have, I had a real battle, and unfortunately I still do a little bit, with gout. And so I would start getting gout, mainly you get gout, I think, in your toes and things like that. But I've had it in my ankles and my knee, unfortunately, as well. But gout is just super painful, but it's another side effect of your body just not being able to process out those toxins. Gout is horrible. And unfortunately, there's some people in our family that it affects very acutely, and we have a lot of problems with it. And then there's other people that it doesn't seem to bother them. It's probably some of the worst pain I've had in my life. I've broken my leg playing soccer, but this kind of pain is just that pain where, you can't move, you can't put anything on it, you can't put any weight on it, you can't wear shoes or anything like that as well.
And it's in joints. And the point of a joint is that it needs to move and it needs to bend. And so that makes it, you can't ignore it. This is a constant pain.
Yes, it was very bad. You really just have to deal with it and try to get over it the best you can. But the other symptom that I just remembered was that our bodies, especially in my family, because I know I'm not the only one who's had this problem, but potassium became a very big issue to me. So I had to pretty much cut potassium out of my diet. And I also had to take this powder that I would have to add to water and, drink that once a day to help lower my potassium as well. Because if your potassium gets too high, it can negatively affect your heart. So you can, your heart can just stop or things like that. And so I was having the biggest issue for me before I got on dialysis was just my diet had basically become nothing, where I could eat almost nothing. I think I lost 20 to 25 pounds of just not being able to eat, being afraid I was going to get gout, being afraid I was going to get too much potassium. I wasn't having a very high quality of life, and that was definitely bothering me.
When Dylan says he had to exclude just about everything from his diet because he had to avoid potassium, he wasn't exaggerating about having a severely, really severely limited diet. Foods high in potassium include leafy greens like spinach and kale, fruits that grow on vines like tomatoes, eggplant, and cucumbers, root vegetables like carrots and potatoes, and tree fruits like avocado and apples and oranges and bananas. That's a huge variety of foods to exclude from your diet.
When you're on dialysis, you usually have a nutritionalist that you see. I would see them once a month when I would go into the center. You have to check in, even though you're doing all of your dialysis at home. You go in once a month to check in with the doctors and the nutritionist. And, you know, she would kind of have, you know, a plan based on my blood results and everything like that. But like I said, they actually want you to eat a little bit more meat once you get on dialysis because when you're having those, your blood or your liquid in my case and things pulled from your body, it can kind of remove some of the nutrients and things that you actually do need. And so unfortunately, dialysis doesn't just decide, you know, oh, I'm going to leave the good stuff and only take the bad stuff.
Again, more proof of how nothing can substitute for your kidneys in a perfect way. Now, it sounds like your life was definitely constricted by home dialysis, but can you kind of compare it to your mother's experience? Was it more constricted by having to go in and be hooked to a dialysis machine than doing it from your own home?
It was so hard for her because, for example, she would go in on a Tuesday and then do dialysis for, you know, what is it, like 4 to 5 hours at least, and then come home and she would be pretty exhausted for almost all of Wednesday. Like she might start feeling better, you know, by Wednesday afternoon, Wednesday evening, and then just enjoy that Wednesday evening because unfortunately on Thursday, you know, it all starts over again. And so she just really got stuck in that cycle where she didn't really enjoy the feeling of, oh, I've just had my body cleansed of these toxins, because she was always having trouble with low blood pressure. The PD version of dialysis is a little less stressful on your body in that way. So I did feel quite well when I would wake up in the mornings. The problem for me is that, you know, a lot of my dialysis happened during COVID, which I think was probably good on one hand because everyone was at home anyway. And so I was just another person at home. But on the other hand, unfortunately, it just meant that I was even more stuck at home because, you know, even when I would finish with dialysis and want to go do something, you know, COVID really was still raging on. I started dialysis in 2019. And so I think COVID was around 2020.
March of 2020, right.
Yeah. And so, you know, I really spent a good portion of my time on dialysis was also during COVID. And so that just didn't help the matters. But the other big thing with doing dialysis at home is it was all on me, which is what I wanted anyway. But basically my, you know, schedule would be wake up in the morning, unhook from the machine, you know, break down the machine, which has to do with, you know, getting they look like big IV bags. They're like 15 pounds or something like that of these big IV bags. And I have an IV pole that would sit next to my bed and the machine. And that would be what connected to the machine and then into me. So I would break those down, break the machine down, turn it off. And then I would start working from home and work until about 2:30, go pick up my daughter from elementary school, bring her home, set up my machine, which took about 30 to 40 minutes. And then my wife would get home from school, she's a teacher. And so that would be around, you know, 4:30. And then I would only have about a 2 to 3 hour window where I could actually spend time with my family and be mobile and be able to do what I wanted to do and just be a part of the family. And so that was very hard for me. I'm good at time management. And so that wasn't necessarily the problem. I could schedule my day out. That was not the issue. The issue was just the monotony of not being able to do the things that I wanted to do on the spur of the moment. You know, if my daughter had something coming up, you know, I could change the days that I wanted to do dialysis. So I wasn't stuck on that schedule like my mom was, where she always had to do Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. You know, if I had something I had to do on a Wednesday, I could say, okay, I'm not going to do dialysis tonight, but I'll do it on Thursday and Friday instead, you know, just to make up, to make sure I'm doing enough.
And, you know, you've set this story up perfectly by drawing this picture of how hard it is to be on dialysis and how miraculous a transplant can be and how much it transforms your life when you can go from dialysis to having a kidney transplant. Before we talk about transplant, though, I want to talk a little bit about health costs and policy, because one of the things that we often talk about on Lifespan is how obviously in the U.S. costly medical care is. But when it comes to dialysis, it's kind of in a unique spot within health policy because the federal government pays for dialysis treatments for everyone, don't they?
So it does in a certain way. I'm fortunate that I've had my job for several years and I, you know, we have health insurance that I can pay for. And so for the first 36 months, I guess, which is 3 years, my health insurance through my job was my primary insurance. But once you start dialysis, you are automatically qualified for Medicare. Uh-huh. And so
no matter your age, we should say.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I am kind of not the norm, and the fact that I was so young, a lot of people have a hard time believing that I was on Medicare. And I was like, well, I didn't have a choice. I was on dialysis. So Medicare would usually pick up whatever my primary insurance did not cover. And I think when I used to see the bills, you know, they would just send you claim statement so you could see how much everything was. But I think it was a cost of almost $40,000 a month for my in-home dialysis, which is outstanding. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's hard to even fathom that amount.
Extraordinary. That's more than $500,000 a year. That's just extraordinary.
It's astronomical. And so, you know, I was very fortunate that I would really very rarely have to pay anything at all, you know, for the actual dialysis things. There were a lot of other things that I would have to kind of help out with. And then after being on dialysis for 36 months, Medicare automatically becomes your primary insurance. And so at that point, things just get a little bit easier because, you know, Medicare does cover even more than my, you know, my insurance from my work did. And so my work insurance then became my secondary insurance. And so I was very fortunate to have insurance. I mean, I can't imagine anyone. I know I'm in some support groups on social media channels, but, you know, there's very few of them who even try to do dialysis, you know, if they don't have insurance, because I've just seen and read horror stories of how much it can cost you, even if you just let Medicare lapse on accident. You know, Medicare, you either pay, I think most people pay every 3 months. I called them and I asked them if I could do a monthly payment plan just so that I wouldn't have to worry about it every 3 months and forget or whatever. And so I was just on a monthly plan. But I mean, you know, I've heard of people who have let that lapse and all of a sudden they owe $20,000-$25,000.
At what point then were you put on a transplant list? How did you make the decision, or how did doctors help you make a decision about going from dialysis to a kidney transplant? Was it a medical necessity? Describe that process.
It's one of the few benefits of having a hereditary disease is that, you know, other family members had told me everything about the process. And so they encouraged me to be, you know, to start the process myself. And, you know, you have to have the doctors and you have to get a referral, but they encouraged me every time we would see our family, you know. So even before I started dialysis, I had already started the process of getting onto a transplant list.
The keeper of the country's organ transplant waiting list is UNOS, the United Network for Organ Sharing. UNOS, a private nonprofit organization, is under contract with the U.S. government to manage the country's organ transplant system. UNOS's waiting lists are conducted largely on a first-come, first-served basis, but that sort of fairness isn't the organization's only concern. So is efficiency. So, UNOS divides the country into 11 regions, and an organ is made available to patients on the list within a specific region. UNOS also takes other factors into account, such as how long is the available organ likely to last, and how long is the organ recipient likely to survive after the transplant. UNOS also takes into account whether someone will be a good steward of the organ. Alcoholics, for example, can't get on a transplant waiting list. So lists are not absolutely first come, first served. Other factors that can get you bumped up on an organ transplant waiting list include: 1, if you have previously donated a kidney to a friend or family member and now you need one yourself, you'll have priority over others on a list. 2, the number of years you'll use your kidney, meaning children and young adults have priority. 3, if you're unusually well matched to a suddenly available donor, you'll get that organ over others higher up on the list. 4, medical need. Those who suddenly need an organ most will get priority for an available organ over others who are not as sick. For Dylan, the patchwork quilt that is the U.S. healthcare system played a significant role in where he got his transplant and what transplant lists he was on. The insurance he had through his job covered his kidney doctor and other doctors at the University of Tennessee Medical Center in Knoxville, near where he lived. But his insurance company did not have an agreement with the kidney transplant center affiliated with his doctor's hospital. But his insurance did have an agreement to cover organ transplants at Emory University in Atlanta and Vanderbilt University in Nashville. So Dylan was on transplant lists in 2 regions: Region 3, which includes Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Puerto Rico, and Region 11, which includes Kentucky, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia. Only after Medicare became Dylan's primary insurance, which happened after he'd been on dialysis for 3 years, would he be covered at the University of Tennessee Medical Center for a transplant. But at first, Dylan assumed Emory in Atlanta was his most likely option.
And I got on that transplant list, and it took about 4 months, just with all the different tests and going to Atlanta and getting the doctor's approvals and recommendations and everything to that point. And we actually had a friend of the family on my wife's side who had volunteered to give me a kidney. And so my nephrologist had told me, well, just get on the list and then he can get tested. And then as soon as he gets approved, you can have the transplant and you won't even have to get on dialysis. So all of this was actually happening before I had even started dialysis, as my health was deteriorating. And then unfortunately, he got denied as a transplant. You know, they would not let him give his kidney to me. And basically there were some health concerns on his end that they did not feel safe with him donating his kidney. And so as soon as we got that very troubling news, you know, that was when I had to seriously consider going on dialysis, because I just wasn't going to be able to do that.
Yeah. So let me explain a little bit that when you are on a kidney transplant list, it is normally for cadaver kidneys. It is for people who have died and made it known that they wanted their organs donated.
Yes.
But you can also get a kidney through a living donor, which is what you just described. But we should also add that when doctors are very careful about this, and you did a great job of describing it, that there are really 2 teams of people. There's a team of people who are dealing with the recipient of the kidney, and then there's a team of people who are dealing with the donor of the kidney. And because of ethics, it has to be 2 different teams, because one team has to really care about the donor, and the other team cares about the recipient. And yes, if there's any reason that the donor's health would be endangered, then they cannot give a kidney, which is exactly what you just described.
Right. And I also just will mention that, you know, they do, I don't know if you want to say recommend, but they do tell us that a living donor kidney is quote unquote better than a cadaver kidney. So, you know, they recommend if you can get a living donor to do that. So I had been trying for about 3 to 6 months before going on dialysis too. I'm not a big person on, you know, look at me, you know, woe is me, you know, all this stuff. And so I did struggle a little bit with telling people about it and asking if anyone was interested in being a donor. But at that point, my wife and daughter were, you know, encouraging me and making sure that that was a high priority of mine to try to find a living donor.
Donating any organ, it's much tougher on the donor, actually, because the recipient of a kidney, almost instantly feels better. But the donor, the healthy donor, you know, that's quite an operation to have a kidney removed and put in someone else's body. So that's an, to say it's a generous gift is an understatement.
It's life altering, and it is, you know, a very unselfish act, and it is a risky act. You know, I did have a cousin who her husband gave one of his kidneys to her. And he, like you mentioned, was much more sick after the transplant than her. And it did take him a good, 6 months to kind of just recover completely from that surgery. But I think the surgeries have gotten better for the living donors. But yes, it's still a pretty significant surgery when you're trying to remove an organ.
After doctors said Dylan's living donor was ineligible to donate a kidney, Dylan had to rely solely on the transplant lists.
I ended up getting on 3 lists, and I was on the list in Atlanta at Emory, the list in Nashville at Vanderbilt, and then finally, once Medicare became my primary, I was able to get on the list here at Knoxville at UT Hospital. And then the funniest part was I ended up having my transplant in Atlanta.
Dylan's rush to Atlanta for his kidney transplant did see some drama.
My daughter and I were at the movie theater, and we were about to go in and see a movie. And the first time they called, I don't hear very well on a cell phone because of my hearing aids. And I just couldn't make out anything they said. I don't know if it was the reception or what it was, but it ended up the call either got disconnected or one of us or both of us hung up. And I was like, you know, that's really odd. And when you've been on the list that long, and I had gotten a call about a few months before that where I was the second one. And so I didn't get that one, but I was the second. So I kind of had an idea that I was hopefully getting close, but it was a number that I didn't recognize. And so I went back to sit down with my daughter again, and then I got a call from the exact same number. And so I answered it again, and I told my daughter, you know, like, I'm going to step outside and try to see if I can get some better reception. And the first thing the person on the other end of the line said is, are you still interested in a kidney? And, you know, at that point, I didn't know if it was a joke. I didn't know if it was a prank call. I didn't know, you know, how the phone call is supposed to start when they're offering you a kidney. But I was like, you know, yes, you know, I would like to have a kidney. I've been on, you know, dialysis now for almost 4 years. I would really like to have a kidney. And they're like, oh, okay, well, we think we have one for you. You know, we have to do some blood work and make sure it's a match, but we would need you to get here by 6 p.m. tonight. And so at that point, it was like 2:30 in the afternoon. And luckily my wife was on her way to meet us at the movie theater. And so I felt like as soon as she walked in, my daughter like ran over to her and was like, you know, we got to go. And so, you know, we immediately started calling our friends and we found a place for my daughter to stay for that night. And then, you know, we were trying to decide who was going to drive from Knoxville to Atlanta. And I told my wife, I was like, you know, I just really feel like if I don't drive, I'm going to be the most unruly passenger you've ever had because I'm going to want to be there so badly. And so she's like, well, then I'll let you go ahead and drive. And so I just, you know, I made the drive. And fortunately, it was on the weekend and traffic wasn't that bad. And so it was, you know, in the afternoon. And so we didn't hit much traffic, but it's just one of those things that you get so nervous and so excited about that I was just, you know, putting the pedal to the metal because I needed to get to Atlanta as quickly as I could.
So. That is amazing. So just so I make sure I understood. So this was, so the first phone call you got, this is all within a short time span. You got one phone call and missed that phone call. And then you got it from the same number again. And they were persisting in getting a hold of you.
Yes, they were very nice about doing that. I think I had read in the rules, you know, like they'll try to call you and then call your backup number for like the first like 30 minutes. And then if you don't respond or, you know, call them back, they move on to the next person on the list. And so I think they do everything they can to contact you if you're, you know, I don't know if they call the top person or whatever, but the person that has the best match for this kidney that is available. And so I was very fortunate that they did call back. You know, I'm trying to learn how I can give back in my own way now that I have received this gift of life and a second chance at life. And that's one of the ways that I've, you know, considered is I just want to promote that donor idea. I just don't think it's a very well-known thing here in the United States about the process and who's eligible and how it can be done and everything like that. So I have been trying to kind of do a little bit better job of promoting that.
And do you know what's so interesting is that there are some European countries where being an organ donor is considered the default. You have to opt out. You have to say specifically, I do not want to be a donor. Otherwise, if you die, they assume you want to donate your organs. In this country, you have to deliberately opt in and raise your hand or put on your driver's license, I want to be a donor. Otherwise, you're assumed that you didn't want to be a donor.
And I think that's a big issue. And, you know, I want everyone to have the choice, obviously, but I think the education side is just not there. And so I don't think enough people know how helpful and useful and how many organs and how many things can be given. I think eyes and things like that can be given to people in need. And I think I just wish we did a little bit better of an education, you know, on that in this country so that more people understood that.
One of the things to me that's so interesting about your story is in terms of finding a living donor is that often people will turn to family, they'll turn to cousins, or they'll turn to, but in your family, you were actually very limited in that sense because this is a family disease.
Yeah, yes, it is. It is a bit of a joke. And a lot of times when people marry into the family, a lot of times the joke is that we have to have them blood tested before they marry into the family, just so we know, you know, who they're donating their kidney to. And, you know, and all of that thing. But yes, it was one of those things where I definitely couldn't really ask too many people on my mother's side. On my father's side, obviously, there were a little bit more options, but, you know, it's a big decision. And so, you know, you can ask and you respect their, you know, decision either way.
Now, talk a little bit about your family culture, because it really is. I mean, you have mentioned family in a generic sense a lot as you've been talking. And, you know, that there's awareness on your mother's side of this illness. It's everyone is aware that this is a hereditary disease. And yet it sounds like most of the family, they had their own children. So talk a little bit about how you feel like that's affected family dynamic, family culture. It sounds like you all have a really healthy sense of humor about this. Talk a little bit about how you think that's affected extended family.
Okay. It has, and it does. I think it changes the topics of conversation at holiday get-togethers. Instead of talking politics and sports, we tend to talk about our creatinine levels and, you know, dialysis and how your kidneys are doing. And I do think humor comes into it on a very large scale because it's something that we've dealt with in our family for so many years now. And I'd say at least three generations or maybe more even have known about it, that, you know, it can become a bit morbid, but, you know, we deal with it in humor to the best that we can. But we also have a very good support network. And so that was another bit of motivation for me to, you know, move to Tennessee once I was finished with my undergraduate degree and not try to go back to Houston, because I knew that at some point I would probably need that support a lot more, not having any family in Houston, obviously having friends and everything like that. But it's just very nice to get calls and text messages and just, you know, the daily questions of how you're doing. Whereas I know a lot of people who, if they're the only person in their family or the first person in their family with diagnosed kidney disease, a lot of people don't understand what that means. And so I think there's a lot of misconceptions like, oh, you have kidney disease, you should still be doing everything normally and you shouldn't have any issues and, you know, all of this stuff. But in our family, there's just such a great understanding that, you know, of what the disease can bring, that everyone is very in tune to, well, you might not think this is a big deal, but, you know, I went through that same thing and you're going to be okay. You know, we can get you through this. And then, you know, once you get the kidney, you know, we're going to take care of that kidney and I can always get advice from anyone, you know, in my family. I think there's two cousins that have already had two transplants. They're both male and they had their first transplants significantly younger than me, like in their early 20s. And so they're already on their second transplant. And so they can, you know, give me any kind of advice or answer questions that I have. And so that's just, it's a wonderful resource and tool that I'm very thankful that I've had, whereas I know many people do not have that.
What is the lifespan of a transplanted kidney? And I guess what I mean, I'm sure it depends on the age of the donor. That's part of it. But also, it's not like you're not curing this hereditary disease. So does your new kidney over time, is it also affected by the hereditary disease?
My understanding is that it is not. From my experience, you know, if you have a cadaver kidney transplant, that organ, I think the average is like, I want to say like 8 to 15 years. If you have a living donor, I think that increases a little bit. We do have one great story in our family, another cousin of mine, and he's had his transplant, I think, for something like over 25 years now. And so I think he's definitely the exception. I don't think, unfortunately, that most kidney transplant lasts that long. But again, it can just be based on so many different factors and how you you have to take medicine for the rest of your life just to ensure that your body doesn't reject this new organ. And so a lot of times you can have rejections, you know, just because of that, your body cannot, you know, all of a sudden not, you know, accept the kidney anymore. And so those things can happen. But, you know, my mother's had hers for about 8 years. I think that was probably about the average, maybe a little on the, you know, lower side. But I think that's what I'm hoping for now that I've had my transplant for about a year and a half. I'm really hoping I can make it last for at least 9 to 10 years. That would be great.
Tell us about the transformation in your life when you did get the transplant.
I tell everyone that any day without doing dialysis is a great day. So for me, it just gave me a new lease on life. And, you know, there were definitely complications. There were definitely struggles, but it's just such a great, almost just a motivating factor for me. You know, things don't bother me as much as they used to. I guess I'm less irritable. You know, I've started running again, which is great for me because I was very active and athletic as a child and even into young adulthood. And so being able to be active like that again has just been great. But also then again, the big thing is the diet. You know, I still have to be wary of what I'm eating, but it's a relief to not have to every day worry about, you know, everything that I'm eating and drinking. And so that is just wonderful. And then I think the biggest thing for me is my family life. You know, my daughter was at that very critical age from about, you know, 6 to 10, 7 to 11 while I was on dialysis. And it was very difficult for her to understand sometimes why I would not leave the room and why, you know, I couldn't do certain things with her, like get in a pool or, you know, just do things like that. And so since the transplant, it's just been very nice for me to be able to kind of rekindle that relationship with my daughter in a situation and in a feeling that she's not worried about my health or, you know, why can't dad do this or why can't dad do that. And so now that she's 12 and, you know, being 13, it's just a very wonderful experience for me to be able to be the father and active father and involved father that I wanted to be. And my wife appreciates the fact that I can also help out a little bit more with driving her to her competitions and things of that nature as well. My mom became an advocate after she got her kidney for people on dialysis because she met so many people doing in-center dialysis for almost 5 years, and she felt that they were very undereducated and not very well represented. But there are people who just do dialysis and they believe that that's what they have to do for the rest of their life. And in some cases, it's accurate and that's not inaccurate, but in other cases, it's just people are not educated on their options. And you know, what can they do? Can they pursue a transplant? You know, can they pursue something? And so that was the big thing that my mom was really, you know, really wanted to push, is to educate the people who have kidney disease and are on dialysis on what their options are.
Yeah, that I would think that that's an enormous failure of our healthcare system if people on dialysis aren't educated enough to know what their options are.
Yes, and she was very upset about that and angered about that because, you know, she was a teacher and everything like that, and she went through it and she's seen our family members go through it. And she made so many friends at the dialysis clinic doing it for 5 years. And then she lost a lot of those friends, unfortunately, because, you know, like I said, dialysis didn't cure them. It was slowing something down. It was helping them. But, you know, eventually it catches up with you. And so, you know, that was something that really hit her hard. And so that's why she felt after getting her transplant, she owed it to them to try to improve that in our system.
And it sounds like you really want to do something in that same vein in terms of giving back.
I do. And, you know, I feel guilty sometimes that I haven't done enough. Unfortunately, you know, I have a full-time job and, you know, it's not cheap living these days. And so, you know, I work a full-time job and I'm still kind of recovering and getting all my medicines in order. But, you know, I try to do as much as I can, whether it be, you know, talking to people, whether it be answering questions. I'm a member of several help groups on social media. And so, you know, I'm just trying to do the best I can. And I do feel, you know, that that's the least I can do.
On Friday, April 26th, 2024, there were 103,872 people on the UNOS list waiting for a life-saving organ. Yet in all of 2023, there were only 23,286 cadaver donors responsible for 46,630 organs going to patients on the UNOS list. One donor can save up to 8 lives. The numbers on the UNOS list vary daily. Every 10 minutes, someone is added to the list. And every day, 20 people on the list die before getting an organ. In the U.S., there is a movement toward legalizing presumed consent to be an organ donor rather than requiring explicit consent for organ donation, meaning that doctors will presume that everyone does want to donate their organs after death unless they've explicitly said they do not. But until we have that sort of organ donation system in the United States, as many European countries do, all of us have to consciously record well before we die that we want to be an organ donor. Every state has a sign-up process, and usually it's as easy as visiting your local motor vehicle office to have your desire to be an organ donor listed on your driver's license. You can do it when you renew your license. Or even easier, you can sign up online anytime at www.organdonor.gov. Organ donor is one word. That's www.organdonor.gov. Just list your state, and the organdonor.gov website will walk you through the process required by your state to become an organ donor. As it says on the UNOS website, make life possible. You can give hope to the people on the National Organ Transplant waiting list. Commit now to giving life to others when you die. Lifespan is a production of WOUB Public Media. I'm Jackie Wolf, Professor Emeritus of Social Medicine at Ohio University and the executive producer and host of Lifespan. Adam Rich is our producer, audio engineer, and audio editor.